Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Sober Indians Wednesday Night Live. I'm Karen, your host, and tonight we have Patrick. He's going to come on and talk about his story. So I want to welcome Patrick to the show. Hi, Patrick.
Thank you. Hello? I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm here.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And, it's a really nice... Sorry, go ahead.
I said I'm honored to have you on tonight. Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. I wanted to start with, if you would, please tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, my English name is Patrick, and I was born on the reservation, so I was given a Indian name at birth, which doesn't always happen, but in this case, it was something that my grandfather did for me and my siblings. All have been given Indian names, which is, mine is Dehahole. Dehahole just means he hollers or he who hollers. It was kind of like a nickname, but at the same time, it was meant to be like symbolic of my great-grandfather. And that's something that people refer to him, although rumor has it that he also drank a lot. So he hollered a lot. And that was kind of his reputation. When he came into a bar, he was always hollering. So on the one hand, it's a really cool name. But on the other hand, it's like, well, is this part of my family tree of alcoholism? And is it something that I should be worried about? You know, and I just kind of ignored that part of being Native American, the fact that there's a lot of alcoholism genetically and also intergenerational alcoholism. I didn't grow up on the reservation. I was baptized there on the reservation, and later on, most of the Native American people in my family who were Catholic kind of parted ways with the church, although my mom did not, because she was not Native. She stayed very firm in her Roman Catholic beliefs. So being raised in a non-Native environment and also not being aware of the religious persecutions that happened to Native people, I was kind of raised in a bubble, kind of, where I wasn't aware of the larger picture, you know, what went on historically. Later on, I found out more about that, but we'll talk a little bit more about that in regards to Sober Indians, because I think it's a wonderful group. As far as my background, I'm 43 years old. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, which is the kind of the Florida-Georgia line, and it's really close to the beach. I went through high school kind of doing my best to stay sober on my own. I realized early on that I was an alcoholic, probably by the age of at least 14 or maybe even younger. And I noticed that I had like this unusual craving for alcohol and any drugs, really, because I just wanted to drink or get high. I didn't really think that I was cool enough to get drugs. So because at that time I had that impression that having access to drugs meant that you had to be part of a specific elite circle of friends in order to have access to those types of drugs, that never really came under my radar. But alcohol was easy to get a hold of for anybody, and oftentimes, as the shy, insecure, nerdy kid in my school, I felt like, well, that's a great way to find out who I am, to go to a party and just see if one of the cool kids will let me have some alcohol. And that's kind of how my addiction began. Like, that kind of opened up Pandora's box for me. That and a little bit of recreational weed here and there, which at the time I didn't really care for it. I was an asthmatic kid, so it was very, very hard for me to smoke cigarettes or especially marijuana. So I kind of avoided that. So later on, I didn't realize these were opening up some gateways to other harder substance abuse and binge drinking and then full-blown alcoholism at the age of 30. So I kind of skipped over my 20s. I did a lot of like soul searching at different points in my life. I was going to Bible college, and then I was also doing missionary work, volunteer work, and, you know, at one point I even became a camp counselor. I didn't know really what I wanted to do. I just thought it would be a fun way to give back. And through some of those periods of my life, I remained sober. And so in my mind, I couldn't possibly really be a true alcoholic, and that everything that I ever heard about Native Americans drinking was clearly incorrect, because I didn't have much of a craving at that time. And what I didn't realize was that my disease of addiction was still laying dormant. Just because I didn't have a craving did not indicate by any stretch of the imagination that I was not a real addict or an alcoholic. Because as we know, alcohol is a drug. It's one of the more deadly drugs, in my opinion, just because it can seem so harmless and it's so easily available and it's legal. And therefore, because it's so socially acceptable, once it gets into your system, it completely takes over and you instantly love the feeling. And so for somebody like me who's automatically prone towards addiction, coming from a very dysfunctional upbringing, a broken home, and then on top of that, intergenerational alcoholism and cultural discrimination, if you will. I'm not quite sure how to coin that one. I don't want to go off on a tangent, but when you're basically raised in a divided household where a mixed child like myself, who was half white and half Native American, is being told that your Native American half is bad, and that is the part of you that's making you an alcoholic, therefore being an alcoholic must be bad. And so I never really wanted to identify with this disease that I have. I didn't want to even acknowledge it, and denial was not even a word in my vocabulary, because I was in denial that I was in denial, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
We know that joke that the denial is a river in Egypt. And although that's funny, when you wake up 30, 40 years down the road and you realize, where has my life gone? What have I done with my life? I drink it all away. Is there any hope left for me? It's no longer funny, because you're coming out of denial, but you're coming into a rude awakening. So nobody wants to wake up and realize that their life has passed them by. That's a very horrible feeling, right? So it turns back to more drinking and more using and harder, more hardcore drugs and substances like heroin or meth, which eventually I got hooked on. The first time I tried heroin, before I go into that, I just want to know if there's anything else in regards to my background that you're interested in hearing about.
What was the vital moment that brought you into the decision of changing your life around? Because I was listening as you were talking, and it kind of brought that out for me.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there probably were a few moments early on that kind of hinted at turning my life around, but those weren't really genuine rock bottom experiences. early on, I want to say, like, in high school when, you know, I started to realize how negatively my academics were being affected by alcohol and some recreational marijuana, I kind of wanted to get clean and sober without anybody else knowing about it and really without telling people that I was sober. I just kind of wanted to do it on the down low, like, I have to do this because in order to get through life, I have to be successful, and that means graduating from college, and that means getting a high school diploma. So in my mind, I mapped it out just kind of real quickly. You know, they tell you to play the tape all the way through, and you can do that without a program. You can do that just by saying, okay, what are the natural consequences if I continue to be a dropout and flunk out of all of my classes because I wanted to drink and go to parties and smoke pot. So that didn't add up, and I went, okay, yeah, I don't want to do that. That's going to end badly. So that's kind of just common sense for some people, not for every addict. But in this case, I really didn't even think I was an addict because it was so hit and miss. Later on, though, once I found myself being a little bit more successful in my career, where I was getting promotions and I became a supervisor working at the Oneida Casino, I was feeling really good about life, and I thought that I could just spend money and go out and do whatever I wanted every weekend. And I ended up out one night with some people that I had known through the program who happened to be also relapsing at the time, but it was somebody I knew who had access to hardcore drugs. And so my drinking quickly turned into more of an exploring, wanting to try out something harder. And I wanted to find out how I could get a hold of some ecstasy. It turns out that this person had a dealer, a heroin dealer, and that they just took my money to go buy a bunch of heroin, which I was shocked at first because I knew I was going to end up trying it because that's how bad I was craving getting high. And at that point, the bars were closed and we weren't even drinking anymore. So the next logical conclusion was to shoot up heroin. I had been in and out of a very, very toxic relationship with an individual that will remain anonymous. I was going through some serious, like, emotional problems and really, really low self-worth, just feeling like I was hiding behind my success and my quick rise to the top. You know, having got out of a homeless shelter and getting promoted to being a supervisor and suddenly having all these new friends that I could drink with and party with, something told me that that was also an all too real low for me. It was like, this is on the one hand, fun and exciting, and on the other hand, very sad, and I feel pathetic on the inside, and I don't want anybody to know how pathetic I feel. So I'm just going to go ahead and shoot up, and I'm just going to go with the flow. If they let me shoot up and I overdose, at least I know I died having fun. And then I won't have to worry about having all of these messed up emotional or lack of emotional sobriety, where the dangerous thing about getting into a relationship when you're that messed up or any type of connection to somebody in a spiritual way, I was truly over my head, if you know what I mean. I was in over my head, and my heart and soul and my mind and my emotions and my spirituality, everything was on the line, and I could not figure out, you know, up from down. everything just seems so backwards to me. And to get high and risk overdosing on heroin seemed like a logical conclusion. It was like, this is the way it's meant to end. And I won't have to think about any of this anymore. It'll just all be over. Well, that was definitely a turning point for me, to answer your question. After that night, I had an immediate allergic reaction to the heroin. And the following day at work, I was supervising at the casino, and my face was severely dehydrating. And after a while, I didn't even sweat anymore because my body was trying to detox. And my face actually ended up drying up really badly. And I had to keep putting lotion on my face because it was turning really ashy. It was really weird. I don't know what was in that heroin. I don't even know if it was what they would consider pure heroin, but it was definitely something my body didn't agree with, and I reacted very badly to it and never tried it again. I'm grateful for that because that very well probably saved my life, because had I been hooked right away, I more than likely would have overdosed at some point because of the amount of, or the lack of, emotional sobriety. It's just a term that I'm familiar with, so I will bring it up again and again. So I hope I don't confuse anybody when I'm talking about sobriety versus emotional sobriety, because there's a lot of interplay between, you know, mental health and well-briety and spirituality and being part of Sober Indians. But that would have been the turning point when I really wanted to get help.
Okay. It sounds like it was a good choice at that point, that it did change your life around. Since you brought Sober Indians, you're very welcome. Since you mentioned Sober Indians, how has Sober Indians affected your life? Because it's a great group. I do know that. I see that every day.
Well, it's been interesting because, you know, once I decided to get help, you know, I was so shook up over the fact that what turned out to be a night of drinking ended up with me trying to basically commit suicide and overdose myself. But the people that were with me either didn't want to watch me die, or they were just too busy getting high. They didn't want to share any more of the heroin with me. And I never know what happened to those two people, but I had to leave that place. And after I did, I eventually got into treatment because I was really shaken to my core by all of this. One day I just realized how self-destructive my behavior was, and I had done something to hurt myself physically, and I had to go to the emergency room. And it was in the emergency room that I realized I'm trying to hurt myself, and I'm doing things that are very, very self-destructive, and I'm sabotaging my own life and my own health and well-being. Why am I doing this? What is this self-destructive mechanism inside of me that is trying to destroy me? And that's when I finally decided to pick up a phone and call a treatment center, and I contacted Jackie Nitschke Center in Green Bay. They were able to get me in right away, and my supervisor, I had received another promotion by this time, and I became an executive host at Oneida Casino. And my supervisor got approval from the general manager to let me go to Jackie Nitschke for 30 days until I could get the help I needed to come back to work. Unfortunately, again, I was in so much denial that when I came back to work, my boss was really worried about me. At that point, I had graduated treatment, but I kind of had made up my mind that I didn't really need recovery, and that treatment was just this embarrassing sidestep that I wanted to quickly forget about and put behind me. And so I stopped talking about it with my boss, and I stopped talking about it with all my coworkers, or anybody that knew me. I didn't want to be associated with sobriety or with rehab or treatment or my experiences there at the treatment center. I wanted to just forget about all of it. And little by little, I found out that that was not going to be so easy. Number one, because several of the people that I was in treatment with began overdosing, and a good friend of mine passed away, and it was somebody that was reaching out to me for help. And after he died, it really kind of just struck me to the core that this disease of addiction is a lot more powerful than any of us even realizes. Even those of us who were actively seeking help, and some of us have died in our addiction, like my friend Josh, there's nothing I can do to stop it. I felt so completely helpless and powerless. And then I heard later that other people were dying too. And although it's not uncommon to hear about a suffering addict or an alcoholic passing away, on the reservation there was a lot of deaths from alcoholism. And people would just contribute that to poor judgment, or somebody neglected to give that person a ride, or that person was going through a very painful breakup and they were trying to drink their sorrows away, or they had so many financial problems that they couldn't cope with life anymore. So we would even admit something was a suicide rather than admit that it was alcoholism. Alcoholism had such a negative connotation because of how closely it's connected to addiction. And the stigma of addiction is so powerful that many addicts just end up dying because they're so ashamed and they don't know how to ask for help and they don't know how to reach out. And that happens a lot in Indian country. We have Native American people that are very proud of their cultural heritage, but they feel like if they ask for help, that they're going to somehow bring shame and disgrace and dishonor to their family by asking them to send them to a treatment program, or to tell them that they need a support group because they're an alcoholic or an addict. A lot of times it's fear of rejection. A lot of times it's our own relatives or, you know, ancestors or traditional ways that have been not necessarily against recovery, because the traditional Native ways are always for recovery. But a lot of the examples, what I'm trying to say is the role model that we were given a lot of times was not the best role model. You know, the relatives and the parties and the drinking and the carrying on all made addiction look like it was something fun, when in fact we had no idea it was something really, really dangerous and deadly, and that it could come for the youngest person. You didn't have to be falling over in the gutters with a brown paper bag to be an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic since I was 14 years old. I can remember telling my friends that because I was so drunk, I couldn't stop remembering what happened to some of my uncles who drank themselves to death. And I couldn't put that image out of my mind. One time I just started crying, and my best friend's mom came out of her house and saw that we were drunk, and she was so mad, and she took all of the liquor out of her liquor cabinet, and she began to smash each bottle on her back patio with a hammer, one after the other, and she was screaming at my friend Billy, and she was telling him how disappointed she was that she saw me drunk. You know, not all of my friends knew about alcoholism on the reservation, but they knew I was Native American, so they respected that about me. And so I think when Billy's mom saw me drunk, she was really concerned. I think she was really ashamed, and she was worried that she had somehow contributed to that by having alcohol in the house. She had no idea that that's what we were planning on doing, was stealing her booze and getting drunk. But later on, as an adult, I had no control. I couldn't go to an office party because I always got drunk and made a fool of myself and passed out. Sometimes they would just put a blanket over me or help me change my clothes because I had vomited on myself. That's really humiliating, you know, to realize that there were plenty of reasons for me to get help sooner. But it took a needle in my arm to really wake up and understand that I had a progressive illness. I had a deadly disease that was not going to stop until I was dead. And ultimately, it almost killed me when I attempted to take my life a few occasions, not just that one time with the heroin, but later on with multiple bottles of sleeping pills. And also I tried, you know, gassing myself with the vehicle. These were all failed suicide attempts. And so I knew that there had to be a plan for my life. I knew that there was a reason why I was coming back to the reservation, that when I found Sober Indians, it was through some friends that got sober who I actually worked with at the casino. And then later on through Facebook, I met Patrick McCoy and several other members of the Sober Indians group who invited me to be a member of it. And actually a cousin of mine who was already a member of the group invited me. I was really grateful that there were so many Native American people who were getting sober. And I had to ask myself, where was I when all of this was happening? Did I miss something? And then I remembered that I had been given a copy of the book called The Red Road to Albriety in the Native American Way by White Bison Incorporated out of Colorado Springs by Don Coyas. And I had been given a copy of that book over 12 years ago when I first tried to get sober through just working in a 12-step program. I constantly was going to counseling, and one of my counselors on the reservation gave me a copy of the book, and she wanted me to read it. While I had given it back to her, I said I didn't want to read it because I didn't think I was really an alcoholic, that all I wanted was just some counseling services so that I can live a happy life. Well, she didn't bring it up anymore, and she didn't want me to feel like she was forcing me to admit that I was an alcoholic. But later on, I remembered that book, and I looked it up, and I ordered myself another copy of it. And when it came in the mail, I almost fell down and cried because I just realized how important the Sober Indian movement is to our First Nations peoples who are suffering from addiction. So that would be the main reason why I'm grateful to be here tonight, share my story.
Very interesting. Well, I'm glad that you're here too, and that you're well on your way with recovery now. I'm gonna ask you what if you had someone come up to you and they asked you for advice. For, and this was, you know, who may be at a crossroad seeking help to begin their journey to recovery, what advice would you give them?
Well, that's a great question, Karen. If I could, that person would probably be my younger self. I'm 43 years old now, but when I started out trying to get sober in high school, I was only a freshman. I would tell myself to stop digging, that my lowest bottom or rock bottom, so to speak, doesn't have to get to the point where I am, you know, overdosing on heroin or passed out in a gutter somewhere with a brown paper bag, mm-hmm. you know, I would say you don't have to go down the excruciating, painful road that so many of us addicts have gone down. And I would say that the first thing would be to ask for help and to get in touch with some of the elders who are familiar with the traditional ways. Or if you don't know anybody that knows Red Road, then go to a meeting and talk to somebody who knows about sobriety and knows about a 12-step program or spiritual principles. Basically anything that is a power greater than yourself that can help you surrender to not only the addiction, the disease of the addiction, but the denial. You know, we have to also surrender to our innermost selves that I truly am a real addict and a real alcoholic, and I have to be okay with saying that and admitting that first to myself, then to my higher power, and then to another human being. And that is working with other alcoholics and addicts who are suffering, who are trying to walk the Red Road. And hopefully from there, you know, start building a better life.
I think that's great advice. I wanted to kind of reflect back on something that you were talking about earlier. You said you was 14, roughly, when you began drinking. Do you think it was, do you think peer pressure may have had something to do with that? Because I know as a teenager, you have a whole lot of stuff coming at you in high school, and everybody saying, hey, you're, you know, try this, try that. But do you think that might have played a role in the addiction as well?
I think so. I mean, I definitely think that, you know, peer pressure and codependency go hand in hand, you know. And for me, I was somebody that, you know, like I said earlier, I felt like I was the nerdy kid. I felt like if I had better connections, then people would be more likely to let me, you know, drink. And it really wasn't about the drinking as much as it was about feeling like I belonged. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I definitely think that the basic human need for belonging is so powerful that if we don't really connect with each other in recovery, you know, we're going to be missing an element of our sobriety, which is belonging. Because some people I know that have been sober for a long time, they still don't have a sense of belonging because they don't have a fellowship of recovery. You know, they don't have somebody else that they can share that with. And so connection is going to be a huge factor to overcome those peer pressures, because it just doesn't go away when you're an adult. The same peer pressure that you had on your first day of high school is the same peer pressure you're going to have on your first day at your new job when you're in an office full of other people that want to go out for drinks and they don't understand that you're battling an addiction. So for me, you know, it was humbling to have to lose everything and end up back in rehab centers multiple times. But this time around, I would have to say that, you know, I was so desperate to be clean and sober after everything that I had put myself through. And once I got out of the hospital after one of my overdoses on sleeping pills, because I had taken 200 sleeping pills, and I was very, very drunk, and I don't know how I got myself to the hospital, but I did. I realized that would have to be the last time I tried to take back the control. And so I had to surrender to my higher power. And even today, I lost my temporary job that I had, but I had already prayed about it and I gave it to my higher power. And I told myself all day today that it was out of my hands. I did what I thought was the right thing. I'm still learning how to walk humbly. That's a big part of working the Red Road with sober Indians, is being willing to be humble before the Creator and asking Him to be your higher power so that we can learn to live together in recovery and enjoy life. Life is beautiful. It's meant to be celebrated. You know, so if I mishandled situations and misjudged other people, I'm so sorry for that, you know, and I'm learning some lessons. I'm still learning some very hard lessons, how to be humble and know when it's my place to stand up to somebody. I hope that I'm just standing up for what I believe in and not because I have let my anger get the better of me. And in this case, unfortunately, it did. So it just goes to show you that even 9 months clean and sober today, I'm still battling some major character defects and not letting my not losing my temper all the time and letting my anger get the better of me. Nothing can drive an addict or an alcoholic back to using and drinking more than a resentment that hasn't been worked on and shared with a friend or a sponsor. And sometimes I share my resentments, but sometimes I feed them. You know, it's that old story about the white wolf and the black wolf. I don't know if it's necessarily about the color of the wolf, but there's a good wolf and there's a bad wolf. And the one that wins is the one that you feed the most. And a lot of times I feed my resentments, and that sometimes surprises me when I walk into work one day and find out that I'm not welcome back. I'm going to be looking for another job. So that is a very humbling dose of my own medicine, because going forward, even if I don't like somebody's personality, it doesn't necessarily give me the right to snap at them or be disrespectful to them. And I don't want to be a bad example of somebody that's walking the Red Road of sobriety. So a lot of it has to do with being willing to ask my higher power for the next right steps, for the ability to know how to handle these situations in the future, so that I don't lose that emotional sobriety that I need. We all need emotional stability, and in recovery, it's called emotional sobriety. And without that, I mean, life can turn around on a dime, and you'll be right back to the insanity, you know, that we are hoping to be restored to sanity. You know, we don't want to be back in the insanity. So I'm very grateful for this program, Karen. Thank you so much for inviting me on to be on the show tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for coming on and sharing your story. It's very much appreciative, and I think that a lot of people have gotten a lot out of this and understand that it's definitely a struggle to get to where you are now. And then it's something that goes on daily, not just 1 minute you're dealing with it, and then the next minute you're in recovery, mm-hmm. and that's that. So I think that a lot of people, you know, that they need to understand exactly how this is and how it works and the process that goes with it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Is there anything else you would like to say before we conclude?
Well, I just want to say I hope Creator blesses everybody who's listening. I'm grateful for you and for this chance to share my story. And Yawanko, that means thank you.
You're very welcome, and thank you. And again, thank you for coming on. I very much appreciate it. Thank you. I invite you to tune in Saturday for the next show, and it was great having you on tonight. You have a great evening, and thank you very much.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye.